I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest in the studio sitting right next to me is poet Joseph Somoza, and his new book of poems just came out, As Far As I Know. I don't mean it came out as far as I know. I mean that is the title of the book, As Far As I Know. It's a fantastic collection put together by Cinco Puntos Press. And Bobby Bird, who is a friend of mine, is the one that told me about this. He says, have you seen this book yet? You got to check it out. And he gave me a copy. And the piece and the music in this book just really blew me away. So I'm very honored to have Joseph Somoza in the studio with us today. Joseph, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You know, and congratulations on this new book. Before we get into it, though, I thought maybe you might tell us a little bit about yourself. I understand that you used to teach English literature and composition here at UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso, when it was still called Texas Western College.
Right.
Welcome home.
Right. My first year was 1966. It's the year after they won the NCAA. Yeah, they're making a lot of 50 years. So 50 years ago, I was here. Right after they won that, it was Texas Western one year. Next year, they switched to UTEP.
Wow.
So I was right at the swivel there.
And I bet it looks exactly the same.
Yeah. Not quite. Yeah. A few changes. The center part is nice.
Yeah.
The fountains and...
Yeah, they decided, I don't know how many years ago, to make it the inner campus without cars and just for pedestrians.
It's
and
perfect.
They've been working on it for years, and it was really irritating having to go around the construction site for literally 2 years, but it was worth it. It's really beautiful.
We've been here at concerts and stuff while they were working on it, so I figured it would be done by now, I hoped.
Well, welcome back to really your first academic home.
First time teaching ever was here. I knew nothing about teaching.
Wow.
Just totally overwhelmed.
Yeah. I got to admit, I knew nothing about teaching when I first... when they pushed me in front of a classroom. And you just kind of pick it up because I you know, you're a writer, and there was a certain point in your life story where you decided you didn't want to be in medical school or you didn't want to be in science, that you wanted to write poetry. And
that's right. And first I wanted to be an English major because I wasn't sure I was a writer. Uh-huh. And then the more I got into it, the more I wanted to write. So when I went to Iowa, I started at Iowa on a PhD program.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marvin Bell talked me into going to the MFA.
Bell talked you into it? Well, that's...
He said, they're going to judge you on your publications, so you want to be judged on scholarly stuff or on poetry, you know.
Right.
So I said, you know.
Was he one of your teachers? I suppose he was.
He was one of my advisors, but I don't think I ever had him. Donald Justice was my main guy.
Some big names out there in Iowa.
In those days, I don't know these days what's going on. This was a long time ago.
It's still a very reputable program. It has great faculty. Even Flannery O'Connor was, one of my fiction writing heroes, Iowa graduate.
They have a prize. I think the prize is given by University of Iowa, I think.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your background. I know you were born in Asturias, which is a region in Spain.
It's northwestern Spain. There's two Celtic provinces in the northwest, right above Portugal, Galicia and Asturias.
Uh-huh.
And like my mother's family are all 5 foot tall and red hair and blue eyed. They look like little Irish people. And also the national instrument is the gaita, which is a little bagpipe.
Wow.
So, I mean, it seems more like a different... Spain is totally like that. I mean, it's got all different regions that are, you know, the Moors are in the bottom. The Catalanes are over there, you know.
Yeah, I was recently in Oviedo, which, of course, is one of the most beautiful cities in Spain and one of the seats of Asturias.
Right. I was born in a village right next to Gijón, which is the second city of Asturias.
Mm.
Oviedo is the capital, I think, and Gijón is the fourth city.
Yeah, incredible energy there. I don't mean to sound new agey or weird and, you know, like I've been to some weird spiritual movements, but that city has so much just incredible energy. I imagine you can put yourself there for a year and write a book, and it would be amazing. And I subsequently found out that there were actually human beings living there during the Neanderthal time.
Oh, could be. It's some people some people say that that's the root. That's where the Celtic people originate, yeah, and moved up to Ireland instead of the other way around.
Right. So you left there at an early age.
I left Asturias when I was five, and then moved with my parents to Castilla, close to Burgos, when I was eight. When I was five, and lived there till I was eight. My older brother developed tuberculosis from a relative coming back from the Spanish Civil War, and so my mother didn't want me to be near him, so I stayed with my grandparents in Asturias. And then when he was okay, I moved to Castilla. And from there, 3 or 4 years later, we came to America, thanks to my mother's relatives. She had relatives in New Jersey, where her family had originally settled.
Wow, that must have been a hard time when you were separated from your brother, not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah, except as a kid, you know, whatever comes, you figure that's normal. You know, you just.
Right.
But then later on, I realized that these old people I used to hang around are no longer there. And we were in America, and soon after they died, and I didn't even know about it. It was weird. So part of your life is blocked out, kind of.
How old were you when you wrote your first poem?
Oh, first poem, probably my freshman year in college at Loyola University. Yeah. I was an athlete, and one of the reasons I got into writing is, of course, my freshman year, I saw an article in Time magazine about Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and he was a football player like I was, and he started out speaking French, and I started out speaking Spanish, so I figured I had something in common with this guy. But, you know, my mother was a reader, and we would have books like Thomas Hardy and Joseph Conrad, books like that at home, and I would read some of them after a while, but I never thought that you could be a writer just to write about your own life and stuff, you know, like the way Kerouac. So On the Road was a revelation. And that's, I think, after reading that, I started writing little poems and little by little.
And what were you studying at the time?
Pre-med. I was a pre-med major at Loyola. My father was a doctor, and he only would support me in college if I would study medicine.
Wow.
So when I switched to English 3 years later, I had to find a night job.
you became a poet and poor at the same time.
Yeah, that's
which,
right. It's like part of the same thing, yeah.
Getting back to your background in Asturias and in Spain, as an adult and as a poet, have you returned to Spain? And how has it affected your sensibility, your poetic sensibility, if at all?
You know, the way I write is pretty much where I am at the moment.
Right. In the backyard, and we're going to get to that.
Backyard, yeah, and right, whatever's in front of me, and wherever that leads, and every once in a while it will lead to a memory from Spain or something, then I'll incorporate that into the poem. But I never have a plan when I go out to write. I'm just hoping that magically I can, you know, fish a poem that day. So I've never made any attempt to write.
You know, you don't say, I'm going to write about Spain and then write about Spain.
But
have you returned to Spain?
Yeah. We've been back a few times, and we go back to, we love Madrid, Gijón. Gijón is the big city near my little village. Yeah. The little village is now almost all like a bunch of factories, industrial park. Veriña, which was a little village when I was a kid, of little hillside farms, and my grandfather had a hillside farm with chestnut trees and fig trees and stuff like that, chickens.
How beautiful.
That's all gone now. It's all been taken over by factories. So,
wow.
But Gijón is a nice place because it reminds me of it. And the people there are all like Spaniards pretty much. You don't see many tourists. It's not a fancy tourist town at all. Just like a real place.
When I was in Madrid a couple of times ago, I go to Madrid a lot. I also love it. But I have a friend who lives there, and she's originally from Asturias.
Uh-huh.
And she took me to a restaurant that was, you know, where the Asturias community went. And it was one of the things that struck me the most, other than the delicious food, especially that dish with potatoes and eggs. And with fried potatoes. It was really, really good. But what struck me the most, being, you know, one who has been known to drink a few drinks here and there, was how they pour the cider. They get that bottle, and they hold it way up, and then they hold the glass way almost to the floor, and they put a bucket there for these spillage. That's really interesting.
I think they must do that to build up the suds more. because you got to, you know, it doesn't have as much salsa as beer. So you build it up by pouring it. Because the first time I saw that, too, I started laughing. I thought the guy was just screwing around. But he was very serious, and he wasn't amused by my laughter.
Yeah, it's an art. It's amazing how they can hold the bottle up so far and the glass so down, and they don't spill anything.
Yeah. That's where all the mozos, by the way, according to my mother's cousin, who I saw there one time years ago, he showed me a place where all the mozos would bring their girlfriends with, and you would see all the corks from the sidra bottles overlooking the port, you know.
Wow. that's a beautiful image. I'm talking to Joseph Somoza, who has a new book out called As Far As I Know. Before, I have one more question to ask before I get into this book and about your life, and that is, you started off teaching here, English and literature, I guess. You ended up at NMSU, which is only 40 miles away in Las Cruces, where you currently live, with your wife, Jill. What's interesting, part of your biography is you were editor for quite a while of really one of the, I think, best literary journals in the country, and I'm talking about Puerto del Sol.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, when I got to NMSU, 73, I think? Yeah, 73. Puerto del Sol had been run by David Apodaca, who has since he was a student, and he graduated, and they had about 2 or 3 years of manuscripts just sitting there because they hadn't gotten anybody to restart it.
Wow.
So one of the jobs that they gave me is like to reestablish Puerto del Sol. And so I and a graduate student and somebody else, I think, three of us decided to put it back. I didn't know anything about typesetting or anything. But I think some of the people who were working with me did. And we went through all those manuscripts. And there was one guy who became kind of famous. He must have had about like 15 letters, each one getting more and more sarcastic regarding his manuscript. Yeah, because they hadn't heard anything for 3 years.
Right.
So we had to respond to all of that and choose the best ones and make that first issue.
Wow.
Restarting the
magazine. What year was that?
73.
73, wow. Yeah. And it's still going.
Yeah, well, then soon after that, we hired Kevin McElvoy, who knew a lot about typesetting.
Fantastic
and
fiction writer as well.
Yeah. And so he took it over, and then he was the general editor, and I stayed on as poetry editor.
Okay.
But he knew how to do all that stuff, so it was great.
When I first started writing, I don't know how old I was. I think, well, I've been, you know, obviously we've been writing since we were children, but I mean, thinking to myself, I want to be a writer. A mentor of mine says, you've got to submit to Puerto del Sol. He says, it's a great journal. And what they do is they write a handwritten letter of rejection to everybody saying what they liked and ultimately why. How did that policy start? Because no magazine does that.
Well, it was very time-consuming.
I bet.
After a while, you know. So when Kathleen West came into the department, I suggested we alternate years. She'd do the poetry editing 1 year and I'd do the next.
Uh-huh.
Just to get away from that. I mean, it was interesting because you're always keeping up with what's happening. You're getting all these young writers sending stuff, so you kind of get a sense of what's happening with poetry. But at the same time, it's totally time-consuming.
Oh, yeah.
And then they didn't drop a course for me or anything. I still had to teach 3 courses every semester. So
yeah, I don't imagine they can do that anymore. I remember when I first started writing, I would get a lot of rejection slips, as most new writers do. Actually, I still get them. I used to hang them on my wall, and my Puerto del Sol rejection, the handwritten rejection, was one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, pretty good. Good.
Let's talk about your book, As Far As I Know. When I was reading this, I couldn't help but think of this quote by Shakespeare. I think it's out of Hamlet, where he says, I could be bound in a nutshell and count myself king of the infinite universe. That's like what your poetry is like, because most of it is backyard poetry. You sit in your backyard and you write poems, but the poems can go anywhere.
Yeah, my wife is also a refugee. She's from Germany, but her parents fled to England during before the Second World War. And we're refugees from Spain, really, like the destruction of Spain by the Civil War is what brought my family over here.
Mm-hmm.
So we both have lived in rented places our whole life till we have this house now in Las Cruces. First time we've ever had a house that we owned. And sitting in that backyard, I discovered it most fully when I finally retired. I took early retirement from NMSU 20 years ago. and vowed to myself that every morning before doing anything else, I would sit in the backyard and try to work on a poem.
Even if it's cold?
If it's cold, I have a chimenea out there.
Right, right.
Just light a little fire. Yeah, a couple of sweaters. Yeah.
Wow.
If it's raining, I sit in the living room. But,
it's interesting that you call this, as far as I know, you have this poem in it, which I really like, called Backyard Poetics. And that could very well be the title of this book.
Yeah. Since I do write, I think the writers that I was attracted to most were people like William Carlos Williams, Robert Creeley, who do take just whatever little thing is in front of them or in their head and just try to go with that and see where it takes them. I'm sitting in the backyard, so a lot of my poems will have images from the backyard recurringly.
And sounds, a lot of nice sounds from the backyard, like you'll hear children or there's this one sound that you expressed that I thought was really beautiful. You're not sure if it was some sort of wind or freeways passing or cars passing
right,
in the distance.
We got a big street, Missouri Avenue, right behind us. But sometimes the wind through the leaves, you can't tell. And I like that. I like being in the middle, like in a rural kind of setting. And we have a double backyard, which is nice. We didn't even know about it when we rented the house, which we then bought. But you have this rural feeling, the total privacy, and yet all around you, you hear the city going on around you. And it's a beautiful double thing because you want to feel like you're part of the human race, but yet you want to be in your own place too.
Yeah. So, and what's really beautiful about the poems in here, you can after a while, I'm sitting in that backyard with you.
Good.
You said something earlier. I don't know if you just said it now or if you had said it in maybe something I had read. There's a little essay in the back of your book, basically kind of describing your poetics in a sense. But you were saying how you just follow the poem.
Pretty much.
And wherever that poem takes you. Can you explain that to listeners who may not understand, like, what does it mean to follow a poem? Because most people think, okay, I got an image, I got an idea, but you don't start with an idea, start with an image.
I like to start with a phrase. I usually take some book of poetry that currently intrigues me. Its language intrigues me, and I take that with me kind of to maybe prime the pump of my own words.
Right.
And I begin reading that just arbitrarily, wherever, open the page. And then I have a writing book with me, like a notebook. And then if a phrase occurs to me, I write it down. And then I try to see if it'll take me somewhere. Because I like the way the rhythm of works of words working together work, the associations that the language gives me. And it depends, like how I slept last night. Did I have a weird dream or, so it might suggest anything. And
that's interesting because, I have a lot of poets on this show and I always ask them how they enter into a poem. And I specifically say enter into it because I think we enter into the poem.
Yeah.
And we stay there and we fill around like Billy Collins might say in that poem, Poetry 101, stay and fill around and let a mouse loose. And, we enter into it like a landscape, even if it's, a landscape that's more of a dreamscape than it is, a literal place. But I always ask poets or often ask poets how they start and, what inspires them. And most of them, the young poets say image. Most of the more mature poets who've been around for a while say syntax, or basically, which is what you're saying. They're, you follow syntax, and if you follow a phrase, and you know it's going to land you somewhere, but you don't know where it's going to go.
It's beautiful. I mean, then you're surprised by what comes out.
Yeah.
That's what I like. I like the feeling of being surprised by the end of a poem that almost got written without me.
Right, absolutely.
Then, of course, you take it inside and work on it. I like the revision part, too. And there, it's more my doing.
Right.
But I want to see what seems to be there, what kind of life seems to be there, and make that better. Bring it out more vividly with the revision, not change it otherwise.
I was recently at a conference, and it was we were talking about poetry. I was on this panel, and I was talking about allowing syntax to lead you into a poem or a work of fiction. And somebody didn't understand, and he asked me to explain it, and I tried to explain it. So I says, okay, I was walking out of the convention center with my bag, going down the escalator, about to meet my brother, when all of a sudden it occurred to me as the bag felt, and I just started going on. When you do that, when you follow the syntax, the reader wants to know where the sentence is going to land. And so there's this suspense. And that's what I like about your work and a lot of work that is, syntactically led, is that we want to know where it's going to go. But as the sentences and the clauses build up or release themselves, images pop out, ideas pop out, and all these things that you wouldn't know that popped out. And that's how I feel about reading your poems. You could be sitting in the backyard and suddenly we're in Spain.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that happens a lot, yeah. One thing I've together with that is I've always loved William Carlos Williams's syntax. The way he's got a poem about this cat, and it's just one long sentence with the thing at the bottom.
Great
where
example.
He sticks his foot in the pot.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you can feel the ligaments of his legs stretching, the cat's legs, you know. He loves the idea of like using words, I mean language, not simply to make meaning, but to duplicate or something like that, the action or the feeling that the poem is dealing with.
It's like the syntax is a representation of the cat climbing down.
Right.
It's called poem, and in parentheses, as the cat. And I'm going to go ahead and read it because it's really short. But yeah, this is a great example. As the cat climbed over the top of the jam closet, first the right forefoot carefully, then the hind stepped down into the pit of the empty flower pot.
Yeah.
And it's like you want to know where that sentence is leading you.
Oh, yeah. And I feel like the muscles of the cat's legs looking for that flower pot, you know?
Right, absolutely. And let me ask you, the title poem is on page 106, as far as I know. And I'm wondering why you chose that as the title.
Well, you know, I had a different title originally. I had a title lately, and because I like the idea of currently, but also late, because I'm getting old. And Bobby said, "Nah, that's not that's not catchy enough."
Right.
So then I looked around and I realized that I wanted to dedicate this book to my mother, who had died.
Right. There's some poems about her, really beautiful, touching poems about her death.
Anyway, and that's one that you know was dedicated to her. And I like that phrase, the play on words there. You know, as far as I know, you know, it could be anything. On the one hand, but as far as I know, I don't know any further.
Yeah.
In a way, like things you learned as a kid from your mother. That's as far as you know. You still have those things in you. So anyway, so I thought that would that played more with language, and it fit the fact that it's about my mother, and I wanted to dedicate this book to my mother.
Wow.
So it all came together.
And you know, it also works on another level, because I picture you in the backyard, and you're in the nutshell, the Hamlet nutshell, you know, in this enclosed space, yet the sounds are really coming from far distance. The birds that you watch on your bush as they fly away, they go into the far distance. So as far as I know, is also an incredibly vast field of knowledge.
Yeah, right. Far could be like in terms of distance. Yeah, as well.
And then you have this line in this poem that I really love. I wanted to ask you about. He says, "After dreaming last night, I'd shrieked my responsibilities as a teacher." And that kind of resonated with me, because even today, I still get these nightmares. They don't happen very often, but I get these nightmares where I show up to a class like a week late and I have no idea what I'm teaching and the students are there.
Totally, man. Totally. I've been out of teaching 20 years and I still get those. Or a pack of freshman comp papers that I had promised to return last week.
Yes.
And now it's Sunday night already. And I know it's going to be another week, you know, and those poor students.
Yeah.
So that kind of, plus, you know, quitting, retiring so young. I retired at age 54, and they were offering early retirement. And I figured, well, give me time to write. But I, you know, sometimes I feel guilty that I should be working. A lot of people are working for a living. You know, I'm just sitting in my backyard.
You know, I wonder that where that comes from, because I know a lot of, when I started teaching freshman composition when I was in grad school, I thought I was a phony. I say, you know, you're putting a phony in front of the class. I don't know anything.
Sure.
How could I be a college teacher? You know?
Right.
And I know a lot of other professors feel that way.
Yeah. But I figured, after a while, I figured, you know, I'm conscientious at least. You know, I know that I'll do the work and try to help these kids as much as possible, and even though I feel inadequate most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then little by little, from the experience of doing it, you feel more confident.
Absolutely. You retired when you were 54. My gosh, you are my hero. I want to do that. And so you just spent your time writing. And
well, that's what, like I said, you know, I didn't want to become a potato. So
I told
myself, if I do this, I'm going to have to work on writing every morning. I went to the retirement office, and the guy showed me a check of what my pension would be. And I showed it to Jill to see if we could live on that. And she said, sure, who cares? Yeah. She's a painter, so she thinks like I do. Freedom is what counts, not money. We never cared about having a middle-class home or anything like that.
Well, that's very inspiring because I'm 53.
One more year, man.
Yeah. I'm thinking, I wonder if I could pull it off. I would still do the show, of course. Will you read a poem from As Far As I Know?
Uh-huh. Hey, how about Vegetation?
Oh, perfect.
Because that's all set in the backyard. Yeah. And it's in a way, it's talking about my love of my backyard. Vegetation. That tall, listing yucca may be looking at me through the hollows in the dead fibers that make up her scraggly face, beneath the green brush cut sprouting from her head with its three antennae that flowered recently and dropped their seeds. We've been facing each other for many years of mornings now, to the tune of dove monologues and dialogues that sound like monologues, and finch chatter whenever I remember to put the birdseed out. Across the patch of sand where leaf shadows are animated by the breezes. Today, Memorial Day, I'm writing this memorial to us before I leave. Maybe when I return, you'll have fallen over, smashed on cinder blocks, and I'll have to chainsaw you to pieces, drag you to the curb, and leave you for the grappler. Or if I don't return, you'll continue sending your cockeyed looks toward the lawn chair by the bench where I would sit, under mulberry boughs that, from your perspective, might have made my head seem to sprout leaves. It's true that I've begun vegetating. The longer I've sat here, the more I've grown resistant to moving, the weaker the allure of distant cities. If I could, I'd probably take root in this backyard and let the seasons send their annual transformations over me.
The book is As Far As I Know by Joseph Somoza. It's got some really beautiful moments in it. And this morning, in preparing for this interview, I went out back in my backyard, I lay on my hammock, and I didn't have a pencil, I didn't have my phone, I didn't have any distractions, and I just listened and watched, and there was a little bird that was hopping around, eating whatever it is they eat in the grass, and there was a distant lawnmower, and I saw a hawk soaring without flapping its wings, and then suddenly started flapping, and I thought, this man's a genius. Are you still going to sit in your backyard and write more poems, or are you done?
Sure. That's the one place where I feel totally at home. I have a hard time writing anywhere else, but you know, a few familiar places that have become familiar. But mostly, my backyard, I just feel complete. It's the place that gives me license to let my mind go, is the way it feels.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I write in my home. I tend to write at my desk. But one thing that I never got used to was writing in a loud cafe where they're blasting music. But it doesn't
matter. That used to be hip. In the beat days, that used to be a hip thing to do. But yeah, it's hard to do. Too many distractions there. Unless you can get used to that. I mean, everybody will find their own place, you know.
Well, I still can't help but think, I shall be bound in a nutshell and count myself king of the infinite universe. Joseph Somoza, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thanks, Daniel. Nice.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you, Joseph Somoza, for leaving your backyard to come and join us for a little while and to share your beautiful poetry with us. See you next week on Words on a Wire.